Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Times Business Podcast, where we look ahead to the stories and events that are going to be grabbing the headlines and moving markets in the coming days. I'm Robert Miller. This week, that means trying to make sense of the far-right movement in Europe and daring to imagine what might happen to the European Union, the currency and the stock markets indeed. In other words, your entire investment portfolio. We also consider the state of the UK listed insurers and underwriters. And finally, we'll catch up with James's favourite car mark, that's Tesla. So without further ado, I'm joined on the line, of course, from New York by James Dean, our US business editor. Also on the line from Brussels, our correspondent there, Bruno Waterfield. And here in the studio to keep me company, Martin Waller, the Times Tempus editor. Welcome to you all. Bruno, if I could start with you. The Dutch elections next month, and obviously further down the line, France is going to the presidential polls. I mean, in both cases, when the far-right candidates earlier seemed to be making headway with voters, it caused a sell-off in the euro and traders scrambling to sort of, if you like, bear that sterling was a beneficiary. This is how Geert Wilders, the Dutch candidate, described his feeling about the European Union to BBC News.
If we want to be liberated, if we want to be a sovereign country again, we need to get rid of this institution that became very multilateral and very political instead of economical how it started.
Bruno, that was Geert Wilders talking to the BBC News. Bruno, just set the scene for us, if you would, and how the next few weeks might unfold and of course, why it matters to us.
Well, the elections are in 20 days' time. They're pretty tumultuous. Geert Wilders launched his campaign last weekend, emphasising his sort of anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant credentials by talking about Moroccan scum and making the streets unsafe in the Netherlands. A bombshell was thrown into the election campaign today because it has emerged that one of the officials of Moroccan origin on his personal police protection team, he's been under protection by the Dutch secret services since 2004, had handed details of his whereabouts over to a Moroccan criminal gang. So this is a really tumultuous election. Wilders is leading in the polls, is leading against the VVD, the ruling Liberals, the party of the Prime Minister, Mark Rutte. His poll has dipped in recent weeks, but is still on track to become the largest party, and that heralds some very, very bumpy times in terms of trying to form a Dutch government. And it will also give a big signal to Marine Le Pen, who is a close friend of Geert Wilders. They share peroxide blonde hairdos as well as politics. So the next few weeks could be very, very, very bumpy indeed. And the implications of the Dutch elections have real consequences for Eurozone stability, which is pretty fragile at the moment.
Surely the more important election is the French election in terms of what happens to the euro. I mean, the French, if the French are down the line, go for Brexit, whatever you want to call it, that surely is the end of the euro. My main concern will more be for stock markets over the next few months, because I think the market is looking very toppy. I've said this for a long time. It's looking extremely fragile. I think of another shock following the last two last year could be very bad indeed for equities.
So, Bruno, what do you think? I mean, is it a rough time on the stock market, our investments, or is it in a way a bit like, I mean, if we could say that Donald Trump was elected on this sort of ticket of stand alone and stand on your own two feet, and their stock market, I mean, the Dow Jones has reached a ninth consecutive record high, so maybe it wouldn't be bad for stock markets. What do you think?
Well, I think the most likely consequence of the Dutch elections, and we're already seeing this with the sort of collapse of the socialists in France, is a period of political disorder where all the mainstream parties are very, very weak. Now, they form a coalition to try and keep people like Geert Wilders and his Freedom Party or Marine Le Pen and the French National Front out of the, in that case, the second round of the French presidential elections. But they do so at a real price. They do so at the price of the stability of government. So what we're expecting out of the Dutch elections is actually a very, very fragile coalition that will take a long time to form, a government that will not be able to take the kinds of reforms that the Eurozone needs. And I think we're going to see the same in France too. French politics is really hollowed out. And if the French political class have to unite around someone like Macron, who's basically unknown, doesn't seem to have much of a political program, that comes at a real price for stability. And one of the things the Eurozone really needs at the moment is a period of stability, because there's lots of reforms such as European bank deposit guarantee that needs to be agreed over the next period, over the next couple of years. And these elections seem to push that away. And of course, you have Brexit in the background. We're going to have very bumpy Brexit negotiations. And that, too, is going to feed into currency instability in the euro area.
James, can I bring you in here? Does it seem like a long way away, this, that it's happening? Well, it is on another continent, of course, but is it something that does interest Wall Street? And, of course, there's a presidential view now. Maybe he was gung-ho for Brexit. Maybe he's equally supporting these people. What's your feeling there?
I think with Trump and the way Wall Street's looking at the wider world at the moment, I still think it's very kind of an introverted view. They're still trying to figure out what the president's doing over here, or at least what he's promising to do. I mean, I think you mentioned earlier the huge rally in the Dow and in other indices as well. Obviously, it's quite spectacular, but a lot of what's happening here is, as a lot of analysts are now saying, all of this kind of momentum is built on promises that Trump has made. Right now, there's a few people getting the feeling that now that Trump is in a kind of, he's kind of hitting up against the wall of reality, which is that he might not be able to do all of the things he's promised to do, be it slash taxes, you know, within the next few months, or spend $1 trillion on infrastructure and wipe away regulation. He realizes now that he's got to get these things through Congress. It's not quite the same as being on The Apprentice and pointing a finger and saying something and getting someone, you know, saying you're fired or getting someone to do something immediately. He has to get these plans through Congress. So there's a bit of a kind of stall over here at the moment. So I think people are reading into that more than what's happening in the wider world. But, you know, as we saw with Brexit, I mean, Donald Trump, I think, spoke very early on about how Brexit was a wonderful thing. He does believe that these kind of populist right-wing movements are a good thing. And he would be probably happy to, you know, to welcome these countries into trade deals in the future if they do decide to leave the European Union, as he's promised to do with Brexit. So I still think it's all a bit unknown over here, and it's hard to kind of gauge what the reaction might be, because everyone's more interested in what's going on within the borders here. But I think in time, we certainly could see some kind of movements, depending on what happens in the elections.
And I think I'd make a very, very sharp distinction indeed between the election of a president explicitly pro-business and the effect on the markets and the Dow Jones and the effect on European markets of the potential threat to the euro. They're quite different subjects.
That's interesting. Yeah, Bruno, what would you say to that? I mean, it's an interesting point Martin made, isn't it?
It is an interesting point. I think the real problem of the surge in populism, the fact that it looks pretty definite that Le Pen will go through to the second round and everyone will have to unite to get a candidate ahead of her, is it does, you do end up with weak government. Macron has, if it is him, does not have a party base. He does not have a strong constituency. He will be the candidate who is not Marine. And that means he is not going to be well-placed to push through the kind of reforms that France and the euro area really badly need. And the same is the case in the Netherlands. It's very unlikely that Mr. Wilders will win and be forming the next Dutch government, much more likely to have a sort of mainstream pro-EU, pro-euro coalition. But that coalition will be weak. And that coalition, because of the strength of the populist anti-euro parties, will not be in a good position to take the reforms that everyone wants and expects the euro area to take over the next couple of years, particularly the issue of completing banking union, which is going to really be in the spotlight with Brexit and the reordering of the European financial sector.
Just looking at it briefly before we move on, Greece, it's there as a sort of feast at the banquet. I know you've been following this very closely. Could Greece be something that actually undermines the euro in the end and not the far-right parties?
Well, I mean, Greece is always there. It's like a ticking time bomb. And every time over the last 7 years, they've delayed the decisions they need to take, which are really about the Greek debt burden in the medium to long term. And really, time is running out. So this summer, yes, Greece is going to be very, very difficult again. The opportunities they've had this year so far to take some difficult decisions have not. They've decided to kick the can down the road as ever. So Greece is back. Greece is going to be back in June and July as the IMF grapples with its conscience about whether it pays out some money in a sort of $6 billion disbursement to Greece. Otherwise, Greece will be insolvent. Again, behind all that will be really big questions about whether Greece is actually capable of particularly reforming its pension system, which is responsible every year for a transfer of over 10% of GDP compared to 3% roughly as the European average. Now, can Greece and can the Eurozone make those kinds of reforms, which means that the Greek economy and Greek debt could be viable? People are pretty pessimistic.
All right, well, we'll leave that there. And of course, don't forget, you can keep up to date. Bruno will be reporting on that, I suspect, almost daily. Now, some of the finance companies are going to be reporting. And Martin, we've already had UK banks reporting their annual results, and we've got a few in the coming days. I call them broader financial companies. We're sort of quite a diverse bunch, from Hiscox and Jardine Lloyd to Direct Line. So when they actually do report, a lot of private investors go into that sector, and you look at it very closely. What's the situation?
Well, I can give you a fairly good idea of that because we've already had two of them reporting, Lancashire and Beazley, two of the less well-known straight insurers, have had put up some extremely good, promising and positive trading statements. They're all doing remarkably well, which those are who can remember the horrors of Lloyd's a couple of decades ago. It comes quite surprising, actually. And I think there will be further good news from the sector. It is a wide sector. I would point out that we have had figures from RSA, which some of us still think of as the Royal and Sun Alliance.
Indeed.
Which were very positive indeed. And it's perfectly clear that the turnaround plan by Stephen Hester, who came in from the RBS, is pretty well complete. Hester made one interesting point when I spoke to him. The big question with these companies is obviously the euro, as we spoke to, and what happens, Brexit, et cetera, and the eurozone. And he made the interesting point where he said, well, 77% of their profits are not made in sterling. And like other insurers, most of them have, he has separate locally regulated European subsidiaries. So it doesn't actually make a lot of difference. They'll be questioned on that, and I've spoken to them about it before. And the line generally is we are so widespread across the world, and some are based in Bermuda. It really isn't a problem. I think what's more interesting is the way that the industry has really turned itself around. It's a lot more professionally managed to the extent than it was a couple of decades ago, to the extent that they're now in a position of having large amounts of excess funds, which they're shoveling back to investors in the form of dividends, which is quite a turnaround.
brief thought from, first of all, you, Bruno, and then you, James. I mean, a lot of these the Deutsche Bank, for example, has a massive presence here in the city. Do you get any sense that companies, are they looking forward to moving greater numbers of people from London to continental European bases? Or do you think a lot of this is actually genuinely scare stories and no one knows yet?
Well, I think the Dutch head of Citi today was saying that the Netherlands will get 10,000 jobs, or so he claims. So there's a bit of hope that that some jobs will come Europe's way. There was a report out by the Bruegel think tank here in Brussels a couple of weeks ago. Now they're very influential. They're very, very close to the ECB. And they're very, very close to the Commission. They were estimating 10,000 banking positions leaving London with another sort of 18,000 to 20,000 ancillary jobs. They reckon that London will lose, you know, something like 35% of European operations carried out by the top five US investment banks, and they seem to have talked to all of those institutions. Now, those figures are bad enough, but they're much, much lower than some of the sort of really scary numbers of sort of like 250,000 that we've heard from the London Stock Exchange. I think some of the worries on the Eurozone side are more about themselves, if you like, which is problems of the fragmentation of their financial sector after London is outside the EU, and the possibility of higher costs in clearing houses, bleeding through to higher borrowing costs for households and corporates.
Brief thought from you, James. Financial companies, obviously a huge sector in the United States. Again, I suppose it's a bit like the Dutch and French elections. Does it impinge much on you when you're going around the Wall Street brokers and fund managers?
I mean, in terms of what they're doing about Brexit, I mean, all of the big, for example, you know, the biggest banks have fairly decent operations, at least the big international banks have fairly decent sized operations in London. And every single one of them has either said publicly that they're thinking about job moves or has potentially leaked numbers to certain newswires in the press and certain press outlets as well, giving figures for actual job moves. Now, I think I don't think I'd call it scaremongering necessarily, because, you know, we've had quite a few months since the Brexit vote to see some kind of clarity from the government about what it's going to do to keep jobs in the city without actually having anything concrete. I mean, it only seems to be sensible planning that a lot of these banks maybe don't want to up sticks completely from London, but to use a kind of management term, want to de-risk their business by moving some jobs outside. So if they're taking certain chunks of their employees and putting them in other European cities, it seems to be kind of a sensible move. But again, I mean, only time will tell about how well the government does in terms of keeping jobs in the city as to how many they eventually move away.
Martin, a final thought with you.
I think that anyone who puts a number on an event which might happen at some stage, we know not when, under circumstances we do not yet know, is talking complete poppycock, whether they're the Bruegel Foundation or whether they're the city. We generally do not know. I personally do not believe that will be a large shift of jobs from the city to Frankfurt or Paris or whatever. This is partly because I've heard it all before. In the early noughties, we were being told, in fact, one of the former Lord Mayors of London warned that Frankfurt would be overtaking London as a financial centre by 2000 and whatever. Doesn't seem to have happened yet. I understand Brexit is a different matter. I don't believe large numbers of American banks who speak English and are already well located, well used to living in London, are going to turn around and move to Frankfurt or Paris.
That's a very upbeat note. Well, we're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll check in on Tesla.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Times Business Podcast is sponsored by Vodafone's Ready Business Britain. 2016 has been branded the year of the SME. This is your year, time for your business to stand out. Are you ready? Vodafone's Ready Business Britain, in association with The Times and Sunday Times, has all the advice, insight and analysis your business needs to make this your year. Get ready. Visit readybusinessbritain.co.uk.
Welcome back. James, we've had some results from Tesla, and I suppose the big talking point is that losses were reduced and the much-trailed Model 3 is about to be launched. Just listen to this update from the latest Tesla Times News online. Yeah, it really is out there on YouTube.
It is pausing Model X and S production
for
a week, starting later this month, to install equipment for the Model 3 production.
Yeah, during this downtime, Tesla will be installing new equipment, including another stamping press, adding capacity to their existing paint shop, and this is all because they're getting ready for the Model 3.
James, very slick, but what do the figures actually tell us?
I think, as you said, the headline figures were better than expected. I mean, it was a smaller loss and revenues were higher. If you drill down a bit further, as is always the case with Tesla, you kind of get to the meat of the situation. So obviously the big news at the start also that they were talking about yesterday was that Model 3 production was on track. And Model 3 is going to be the big thing for Tesla. It's going to be its first mass market car. It's not just sports saloons or SUVs. This is actually something that could sell in large numbers. And therefore, there are high hopes, and investors also have high hopes for it, despite the fact that nobody's tested it yet because they haven't built one for testing. So there's a lot of hyperbole, as is always the case with Elon Musk. Underneath the headline figures, you actually see that their revenue from cars actually fell in the last quarter of 2016, down to $2 billion, and cars are by far the biggest part of Tesla's business. The company also delivered fewer cars last year than it said it would, delivered about 76,000, just over. It said it would actually deliver, well, it predicted at the start of the year that it had delivered between 80 and 90,000. And as was alluded to in the clip just then, Tesla is kind of changing the way it's changing its manufacturing processes to prepare for mass production of the Tesla 3, of the Model 3 later this year. And it said last night that it was going to spend between $2 billion, $2.5 billion to do that. And this was after it spent $1 billion in the last quarter of 2016, various capital expenditures. So it's burning a lot of money. It's still making a loss. It still hasn't actually made its first mass market car for testing, and deliveries are down on those that it already does produce. So it's difficult to say what's going to happen. I mean, Tesla is valued very, very highly at the moment. It's actually valued as highly as some traditional motor manufacturers, though being the petrol motor manufacturers that have been around for decades, if not more than a century. It's valued at just over $40 billion. So investors' expectations are high, but you have to wonder at some point whether, you know, this Model 3 is actually going to push Tesla through into being a serious profit-making company, or we're just going to keep getting more and more hyperbole from Elon Musk, and the company's just going to keep burning through more and more billions of dollars, and it's going to keep missing its delivery targets, which it seems to do fairly consistently.
Bruno, just a final thought perhaps from you. Electric cars, big over here. I mean, I've genuinely no idea. Do you see a lot of them where you are? And of course, you travel extensively around the continent, not just France, Germany, Brussels, everywhere, Netherlands. What's the state of electric cars? Tell us.
Well, there's a sort of couple of places where they have sort of charging banks for them outside the European Parliament, because the MEPs like all that kind of stuff. But I'm afraid I don't really notice them when travelling around. I'm usually looking out for some nice old vintage cars, like the sight of a Citroen DS is more likely to get me going. I'm afraid. So I have to say that I do not notice electric cars in my travels.
They seem to be most common in California, actually. I think it might be the kind of, they're all kind of up on their green credentials over on the West Coast. You do see a few on the East Coast as well, but I mean, for sure, they're nowhere, you know, these cars aren't produced in anywhere near as large numbers as, you know, the Chevys that General Motors puts out, or, you know, the Fords or anything like that. So this is still a small company in comparison, despite the fact that its valuation is so high.
California, if only I could play us out with a Beach Boys record, but I don't think I dare push that one. Anyway, that's it for now. But remember, you can keep up to date with all those company results and events we've been talking about on your phone, tablet, and don't forget, in the paper. If you'd like to become a subscriber, you can sign up at thetimes.co.uk. It costs £1. And that's, of course, going to give you access to the free morning and lunchtime business emails. We're on iTunes, so if you want to hear us weekly, just simply subscribe and do feel free to post your comments. My thanks to James Dean in New York, Bruno Waterfield in Brussels, truly international today, and Martin Waller here in the studio with me. They're all on Twitter, so please do follow them. And please join us again next week. Thanks for listening.
The Times Business Podcast is sponsored by Vodafone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready Business Britain.